healthcare system can be confusing, frustrating, and at times, downright scary. Here to help clear up the confusion, putting an end to the frustration, and making it a lot less scary, from Los Angeles, are your hosts, Eric and Roy, on the Informed Patient Show.
Welcome to the Informed Patient Radio Show, and we are your hosts, Eric and Roy. This is the show where we help take out the confusion of the healthcare system. Today's show, we have a special guest, Dr. Michael Cortez of Vitas Hospice. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cortez.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Roy.
We'd like to always start out our program by getting to know our guests a little bit. So if you can just kind of briefly tell us how you got yourself into medicine and how that led to what you're doing currently now.
I was natural in the natural sciences, very easy for me to excel in an academic way. And during my undergraduate years at UCLA, I was fortunate enough to work for their ambulance program. And it was very exciting, great equipment, great fellowship with other students who are working on the ambulances. And
wow.
I'm a CPR instructor and worked in the police department as a station officer and things like that. And it was just a lot of fun. And I was a bit uncertain about whether or not I was going to migrate towards biology and teaching biology and research in biology or medical school. And that pretty much cemented it. And then went to medical school. After medical school, went to family medicine residency training at Long Beach Memorial, an excellent program. And after my exposure to hospice medicine, as part of my work as a family physician for years, I became more and more involved in the hospice side, recognizing that there was a need there for compassionate care, and that grew into palliative medicine, which is really focused on patients with complex medical issues, where we try to find the best quality of life for these patients with significant needs.
Right. So, let's talk a little bit about palliative at this time. What kind of patients or what kind of problems do the patients bringing to the table when they seeking out palliative, and who refers to palliative? Is it self-referral, or does referrals come from other healthcare providers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Eric. Usually, I see patients for the first time in the hospital. People look at me and say, well, what's palliative medicine about? They know if you break a bone, you're going to see an orthopedist.
Right.
If you have a heart attack, you're going to see a cardiologist. What do you have to break to see a palliative medicine physician?
Yep.
And the answer is you have to break your quality of life, because palliative medicine is about advocating for the patient to optimize their quality of life, given the clinical scenario and the social scenario that the patient lives in, what their resources are as well. Okay, so you're taking the entire milieu of the patient, their issues, their families, their physical problems, very often their psychological problems, and you're trying to negotiate through this very complicated medical system in order to find the best possible quality of life for them, given the limitations that you have and that they have.
Right. And what are some of the barriers to quality of life that you've seen?
Well, starting with dignity and comfort, first and foremost.
Okay.
Okay. So if you have pain, we want to address that. We want to minimize the pain and maximize the patient's ability to interact with their family, with their friends, to enjoy food, to enjoy their faith, to enjoy companionship, and exist as comfortably as possible. If we can get them home, that's always preferred, especially if the patient voices that is preferred. But we try to make sure that the patient is given the best quality of life possible.
And this also can be through, I would imagine, like pain control, symptom management, and like say if they're undergoing chemo, therapy and they're having a hard time with the side effects. Palliative care can come in alongside, I would imagine, and help improve the quality of care, because chemo can really wipe you out and do a number on you.
And we work with the patient for a wide variety of symptom mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
And always asking with them, not only how are you now, but what can you anticipate going forward? So I'm also an information conduit, talking to the other specialists involved in the patient's care.
Okay.
So that I have as thorough an understanding of the whole picture, the big picture,
mm-hmm.
not just a small piece of the picture. I bring the big picture to the patient, to the family, and what is reasonable to expect going forward.
Right.
Anticipating that. What can we put in place, again, to maximize your quality of life?
And you're also assessing other areas, I think you touched on, like spiritual and social. So you're kind of assessing for that as well. And then it would be you that would maybe make a consultation to spiritual care, like chaplain or social work or other things like that. Am I correct?
Absolutely. It's a very, very important part of a person's life is to include their spirituality and or lack of,
mm-hmm.
But at least it gets addressed, and we want as comprehensive a care plan formulated and enacted with every patient as possible.
Yeah. Do you see that palliative care, is it normally taken care of by insurance? Do you see a lot of insurance health plans covering palliative care on top of a patient's regular treatment plan?
In the hospital environment, it's covered.
Okay.
In the outpatient environment, and I do home visits,
mm-hmm.
The Medicare will cover physician visits, PA, and physician assistant visits, nurse practitioner visits, not nursing visits.
Okay.
Okay. And we have found through our contracts with large organizations that through our efforts where there's initial evaluation with the physician or the PA, and then follow up with a nurse or a CNA.
Okay.
Patient satisfaction is very high. Return to the hospital via the emergency room or return to the urgent care center drops off rather dramatically.
With the use of palliative care.
With the use of palliative care in the home.
That's very interesting.
Unless you're a large organization, you won't have an office, because if you're an individual, there's a 50% recidivism rate with people showing up to the to your office,
mm-hmm.
because they tend to be rather sick people in the first place, and often they'll go on to be hospitalized or have a dialysis appointment that interferes themselves onto a hospice program, and you don't get the phone call. So as an individual, you don't do a palliative office very effectively, but if you're a very large organization, you can do that.
Okay, very good.
So, Doc, I wanted to ask you about, the consult for palliative care versus a pain management physician consult. If somebody's getting a pain management consult, are they not getting all the other things that you would get with a palliative care consult, or how does that parallel?
Yeah, Roy, that's a great question. As a pain management consult, the pain specialist would come in and they're expected to deal with the patient's pain.
Right.
But there's different forms of pain with every patient. In palliative medicine, you deal with the pain syndrome as well as other syndromes, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, depression. Also, you're interacting with the family. So you're taking the whole picture. And very often we're meeting with the family and we're sitting down, and with the patient, if they're able to, and we're sitting down and we're going through everything so that the stakeholders and the caregivers involved with this patient, hopefully including the patient themselves, are involved in understanding what's going on. So one of the analogies I use is a specialist comes in, let's say a cardiologist, listens to the heart and tells the family, okay, this is what we found today, and this is what we're going to do. Okay, that's great, and that's appropriate. But it's a very small part of a big puzzle, and it's hard to fit that in context if you're not a medical professional.
Right.
Okay, so what we try to do in palliative medicine is provide context, and these are the reasons why these things are happening and what you can anticipate going forward. It takes a lot of the mystery out.
Okay. Oh, you're providing a navigation as well, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you, how has palliative care been received in the hospital, like amongst, you know, other profession or other specialties within the hospital in the physician community? How, what have you seen?
Well, some physicians view palliative medicine as hospice light, meaning you're going to talk to the patient about code status and they're likely to go on to hospice from there. And it's not like that at all.
Wow.
If the patient is appropriate for enrollment in a hospice service or program, that will be brought up as one of the options.
Sure.
Okay. But I can tell you some of the physicians don't really understand it. The case managers love it because we help case managers navigate. We sit down with the family and we get a really good appreciation in general for what issues need to be addressed. And it helps with greater comfort in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And it also helps the family start to plan for the next step.
Right.
And this happened to me. My dad had a medical issue, and we thought everything was going well. And I get a call in the evening: "Your dad's being discharged tomorrow." And really,
thanks. Yeah.
Okay. So, when I get involved with a patient's care, I tell the families reasonable timelines for things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
To start, if it is anticipated that the patient will go to a skilled nursing or an assisted living facility, go out there and start interviewing these places now.
Right.
So that there isn't this panic at the last minute, which is very common. And I start discussing with the case managers getting the proper equipment in the home ahead of time. So what that does is it eases the transition of the patient from the hospital to the next step in order to help reduce anxiety and make it a better handoff, so that there's less likely a turnaround back into the hospital.
Right. Yeah. Now, if a patient is sitting there and then after they listen to this show and stuff, and they say, "Boy, that sounds like something I think I want to be involved in my care," how does one get a palliative care consult? Does it always have to come from a physician, or can a family member, you know, talk to the case manager or talk to the nurse, say, "Hey, I'd like to see if palliative care can come by and take a look at my case or something"? What would be the most appropriate process?
In the hospital setting, you always want to ask, who is the primary physician on the case? There is a primary attending physician associated with every hospitalized patient, and go through them.
Mm-hmm.
Ask, "Hey, is there a palliative medicine physician here that you trust and you would like is appropriate for working with us?"
Right.
Okay. In the skilled nursing facility, you can ask either the medical director of the skilled nursing facility or the attending or both, and say, is there a palliative physician that comes to this facility? And sometimes there is. And do you think we should be working with them? One of the things that palliative physicians are very good at in general, at least in my practice, I know this to be true, is to spend time with patients and their families.
Okay,
and
that's a good thing.
Yeah, and with quantity time comes quality time.
Yes. Yeah, in today's world, I mean, and Roy and I can just speak to this very well, that when we were floor nurses and also case managers, the physicians are extremely busy. An attending physician can have a huge panel, not only patients in that hospital, but in other hospitals, their time is just stretched really thin. So they can spend, 5 minutes maybe with the patient and hopefully with the family, but can't really explain a whole lot. So you're saying that the palliative care physician can come in, spend more quality time, fill in a lot of the gaps, and kind of and give the overall picture, but not just the picture, but the possible plan ahead.
That's a good way of putting it. That's what we do.
That's very good. And if the patients might not know if they qualify for a palliative care consult, should still speak up and say, hey, I've heard about palliative care. Can they at least take a look at my case? Is that a fair thing to request from the patient to the attending?
Sure, sure. And I tell people all the time, if you don't advocate for yourself,
right,
you're shorting yourself.
Right. Very good. You have any other questions, Roy,
well,
that you can think of?
Yeah, I was going to ask. So yeah. It always has to be a physician that gives the consult, right? That there's not a nurse that can do that, or I guess a nurse practitioner could write an order for something like this?
Well, usually what happens is the doctor, the attending physician, or one of the other physicians in the case, especially physicians tend to work in groups that they're comfortable with. So
right.
It eases communication. There's clarity of communication. There's ease, and everybody's on the same page. So very often they'll ask the nurse to put a request, or the case manager to put a request in the chart, either electronically or put a note in the chart requesting it. So, you know, that avoids the appearance of a self-referral.
Right.
That's important. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Always important.
Very nice. Okay. So I think we have a good idea what palliative care is. Now, by contrast, let's talk about maybe the differences when we talk about hospice, or maybe you can compare and contrast and why hospice is important, and we can start having that conversation.
Great. You know, we consider palliative medicine to be advocacy for the patient's optimal quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hospice medicine is really for those patients where there's a reasonable expectation of the patient passing within 6 months,
okay,
given the clinical issues.
Right.
And the patient and the family has determined that they no longer want to pursue aggressive management of these issues. Mm-hmm. They want to pursue comfort-oriented care.
Right.
Okay. So what happens then is Medicare, which funds the hospice programs in general, for those 65 and above or with Medicare benefits.
For disabled folks in end-stage renal.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there's always, you know, you can always contract, or there's always volunteer hospice as well.
Mm-hmm.
they determine that you may pursue hospice care, and they will reimburse for hospice care, or they will reimburse for aggressive care.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take the example of a patient with cancer. Okay?
Right.
You cannot be on hospice and still go see your oncologist and continue with chemotherapy and radiation therapy and surgery. You can with a palliative care physician, but palliative care services are much thinner compared to hospice services, which are much more comprehensive.
Okay.
So once the decision has been made to pursue comfort-oriented care, you get a hospice team. You get a physician, an RN. You get CNAs or LVNs or home health aides.
Mm-hmm.
You get medical equipment, and you get chaplaincy support, and you get case management support. With palliative medicine in general, I show up, and as a follow-up, if I'm contracted with that provider agency, and they say it's okay for me to send in a nurse, then we'll send in a nurse or a CNA or whatever is appropriate to maintain comfort in the home. But
okay.
So think of palliative medicine as another specialty involved in the care of a medically complex person.
Right.
With hospice, the primary physician usually remains involved with the patient's care. But the hospice team is really working with the patient to maintain the best quality of life, knowing that they're not going to return to the hospital, most likely.
Okay.
And they desire to remain in place, so to speak, and just be made as comfortable as possible while their life-limiting illness progresses.
Is, and now, for sake of clarity, can you give us maybe some typical patients that you see? Because I think the media in general has done a horrible job in describing hospice when it in movies or television shows. Because when you say hospice, and when I've talked to patients and family about hospice, they think of the dark room, someone lying in the bed, and, you know, they can barely talk, and there's a vigil by the nurse holding the hand and stuff like that.
Right. Represented more like a TB sanitarium.
Yeah.
Sanatorium than
right. They automatically think of hospital bed and IV poles. And
you're in a dark corner with...
in a dark room and stuff like that. But I would imagine that maybe that's more of a rare case, or, you know, can somebody on hospice go be enjoying themselves, like go to Disneyland? Or quality of life. Do they have to be someone lying in a bed?
Quality of life is really it. Okay. Now, the limitation given to the patient by the disease process, you have to work with.
Okay.
But as an example, a number of years ago, I took care of a young lady who had a metastatic cancer, and her goal was to spend a week on the beach in Cancun.
Okay.
Okay, and she weighed 90 pounds dripping wet, and I'm pretty sure about 20-plus pounds of that was tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But she had terrible, terrible pain. So we worked with her to find the right medication milieu to reduce her pain to the best levels possible and maintain her level of consciousness.
Sure.
She got on that plane. She spent the week on the beach in Cancun.
Nice.
She got back home and big smile on her face. And she passed shortly after that, but she had achieved what she wanted. So it's important for people to verbalize to their care providers always, what do they want? Okay. Mm-hmm. Let us know what your goal is and we'll try to get you there.
Very nice. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, so they want to maybe spend more time with their kids, or they want to be able to go up a flight of stairs without being absolutely winded that they can't. Or they want to go and spend time at the museums and other things like that.
Exactly.
So to be your job is to figure out with them, like, how can I get you to where you can go do those things in relative comfort?
That's correct.
Right? Because it's all about quality.
Sometimes it's just get me on a plane so I can go back to my family or country of origin wherever. And how is that going to be possible? Very often they're asking for letters for us to pen for embassies around the world in order to get visas for family members to come out.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow.
And we tell That's them what will work and what won't work in terms of, you know, some people want to go to, they want to go across country. Well, if you're on an oxygen concentrator, check to see with Amtrak or whoever, you know, if their train can accommodate that. And, you know, you have to know the practicalities of going to driving to Las Vegas from Los Angeles, which is you're going to be at over 5,000 feet for a while. And if you have trouble breathing, that's not going to work. And if you're going to fly in an airplane, they usually pressurize the cabin to about 8,000 feet. So, again, if you're oxygen dependent, that may not work. So we talk about what's practical, and that allows people to make alternate plans that will work for them. Again, optimizing their quality of life.
Okay. Well, that's another big question. Do you feel that patients are entering into hospice at the right times or too late?
Okay. Well, let's clarify. Every state is different when it comes to hospice,
right?
Because there are laws in every state that are a bit different. Hospice is a service; it's not a place. And a lot of people think of hospice as a facility where people go to die,
brick and mortar. They think,
yeah, exactly. It's not like that. There are a few inpatient hospice units around, and that's usually for stabilization of patients' discomfort until we can then move on to the next stage, which is returning home or assisted living facility or skilled nursing facility.
Right.
Or sometimes back into the hospital. It all depends.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're not rigid. You're working for the patient. Remember, you're being the patient's advocate. Okay. But you have to work within a system and you have to let them know what that system is. Okay.
Right.
What was your question again?
Oh, just saying. So far since you've been doing palliative care in hospice, do you feel that maybe the conversations are happening a little bit too late, or should we be talking about this earlier? Do you see people? Because as a case manager, I unfortunately see patients enter into the hospice, like I've seen them like a couple days before they pass.
Same day.
And I'm that seems just way too late. And what are some of the barriers to this?
One of the most frequent comments we hear from patients and their families is, if I had only known about this earlier, we would have enrolled a long time ago. Okay. One of the issues with palliative medicine is to talk with patients about reasonable goals and expectations. Okay. So I always bring up all the options that I'm aware of for every patient. And by having informed them to the best of my ability, they can make the best informed decision. But if not, if they're not informed, they're deciding without knowing what's available to them. So it's very important. Again, that is quality time because of quantity time.
Right.
Okay. And somebody who knows how to navigate the very complex medical system that we've built up here in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have so many options, it's just become incredibly complex, and it's very difficult to grasp all of these options that are available to us.
Right.
Before the show, Eric and I were talking about hospice and admissions and that thing about coming on to hospice later. And I told him, I said, with my experience and my background, I said, I can't tell you how many times that I heard families say, gee, I wish I would have known or understood about these services much earlier and could have been having all this support all along. They just don't realize the dynamic of all the team and all the people that are involved, from non-denominational chaplains to volunteers to the physician making a house call, the nurses in the field, nurses in the hospital. You got a call center. It just goes on and on and on. And all the other services that are offered, like a continuous care if you need it, or a respite care that, we'll have you...
But is some of the problem the doctors are not advocating for early meetings or conversations, or what have you been found? What's some of the barriers?
Well, palliative medicine is young. Okay, it's a new specialty. Doctors are they have strong personalities. They're used to seeing problems and tackling them themselves.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Patients don't know in general that palliative medicine is out there.
Mm-hmm.
Hospitals in general are waking up to the potential for palliative medicine in terms of getting better patient outcomes, not just in the hospital, but also once the patient leaves the hospital. And hospitals are being taken to task about recurrent admissions.
Yes, readmissions and withholding reimbursement.
So the initial incentive for the hospitals has been definitely a financial one, but also when you're looking at people as not just patient lives, but human beings that you would want to see at your family reunion, it takes on a whole different shape. And we're just working for optimal care that's reasonable outside of the home. Outside of the hospital and going forward.
Right. Now, would it be reasonable, say, a patient has, let's go back to cancer. A patient is going to start curative or is on curative, but maybe the docs and the team, they can't really tell the patient what the prognosis is really going to be. It's kind of a tenuous situation. Can the patient and the family have a consult with hospice at any time? And is it a good idea to just kind of see what's out there and what their options are? An informational meeting, would you advocate that?
I do that all the time.
Okay.
And I tell patients, well, you know what? It may not be appropriate at this time, but at least you know what your options are, what it is that hospice is, by meeting with a representative or two or three. You have options. There's more than one hospice organization out there.
Right.
Meet with them and see what they can do for you, whether or not it's appropriate for you at this time. Mm-hmm. You don't have to make a decision today.
Right.
Right? But we want you to know so that you can start making plans. You can start preparing for things going forward.
Yeah, because what we've seen is, hospice is not talked about until it's almost for sure the physicians finally say, yeah, there's no hope, you're going to pass. So maybe you want to talk to hospice. And that's an emotional roller coaster right there. They're coming in saying, we're done, pretty much, we can't do much. That is a blow to the human being anyway, but then say, maybe you want to talk to hospice now. So they're trying to process a lot of this, and now you're saying, I need to talk to this other entity called hospice. So that's why I'm saying maybe it would be, regardless of whether, maybe if it's a cancer, the doctor goes, listen, a couple of chemo, some radiation, we pretty much got this, not a problem. But how about the cases that, we've only got maybe a 40% cure rate on this or something like that. Would it be appropriate to just kind of talk to everyone, including hospice, just in case? And then that way it's not such a new concept if the patient ends going that way. So that's my thought process.
Well, that's the importance of a program like this is so that people know what their options are out there.
Yeah.
So we would like them to know about hospice so that they don't feel that, well, if we stop chemo or radiation or surgery in the case of cancer, that there's an abyss right after that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, I'm getting hit with it all of a sudden, like a stone wall type thing. They've already been kind of eased into a lot of it.
Right. And there's a support structure there. If, let's say, you're in a round of chemotherapy and you say, you know what, this isn't working for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where do I go from there? Then my oncologist isn't going to continue treating me if this is the plan.
Right.
Well, there are alternatives to the plan always, and you should be aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say usually. I'm sorry. Let's strike that. Let's just say it's not uncommon for myself as a palliative physician to be involved in a case within hours of the patient's expected passing.
Mm-hmm.
So as a palliative physician, of course, I would like to be involved earlier in cases where it is reasonable to involve my services earlier.
Right.
In hospice, that happens very commonly, that people pass within 48 hours of being enrolled in the hospice. And it really takes about 2 weeks for a good hospice team to sort of get in the groove with the patient and their family, setting up the equipment and meeting everybody who's there to help you. So, but it's unfortunately, it's very common that people are referred to hospice at very, very late stages in the process.
Well, hopefully, with the help of our show and our guests on there, I think we can maybe start changing that trend.
What about, some cases where somebody's on hospice for a month or two and they said, you know, I really should have continued with some aggressive treatment or something. I want out of this. I mean, are your feet going to be held to the fire because now you've done this and it's going to mess up everything? Or?
Yeah, hospice is about patient advocacy for dignity and comfort during a very difficult part of somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, if you decide that hospice isn't right for you, and it does happen, you can disenroll, and then you can re-enroll later on. Okay? It becomes problematic when people and families sign on to the hospice service, and then they want to go to the emergency room when expected downturns occur instead of staying at home.
Right.
Okay, that becomes problematic. But otherwise, no, it's not rare that people will disenroll from hospice when they decide that they have heard or seen something new and they want to pursue that. That's reasonable.
Mm-hmm. That we see that sometimes. I've seen patients come off hospice because another physician might have just one other option that they would like to try, and so they'll get off it to go maybe give 3-4 weeks of try of this, and if not, they come back to hospice.
Exactly.
But I have seen, like you were saying, exactly nailed on the head, somebody goes in, and then say they become, one night they become very short of breath, scares them, and the first thing is, I don't think I'm ready right now, disenroll, and they go in the emergency room for some breathing treatments and other things like that. So I've seen that happen. Now, but let me ask, when things like that happen, do you think it might be partly because maybe the expectations were not set maybe very well? Like, yeah, you will get short of breath once in a while, but we can put a plan in place for you and then just, you know, we can work with you on that, or, you know,
right,
I don't know, maybe
right.
You can speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, plans are promoted, right? And the problem is that perfection is difficult to attain. So things happen. You know, the organization that I work with, VITAS Hospice, is very good about having a roving nurse in our area.
Right.
And they can respond within 2 hours. But if the freeway is jammed because of a traffic accident, things happen like that. But there's always a doctor on call as a backup.
Mm-hmm.
We do house calls as physicians as well when we can. And we have other resources available to the patient. But, you know, there's no perfect plan. We do the very best that we can, and it usually works out quite well. But, yes, occasionally there are failures, and occasionally people will go to the emergency room. And usually they won't.
Yeah.
Because we'll enact a new short-term interim plan until the situation is reassessed and restabilized, and then we go on from there.
Very nice.
Every day is reassessment day.
Yep. Yes.
Right?
That's right.
Well, Doc, let me ask you a quick question here about hospices in general. And you know, you mentioned that you're with VITAS Hospice. I know they're, if not the oldest, maybe the largest hospice organization out there. And it seems like every time we turn around, especially in the case management business, like Eric and I, there's another hospice popping up. And I know they're not all equal. And with all the services that are offered, I just don't see how some of these new mom and pop type ones can offer the same type of service.
I have worked for other hospices in the past, and I'm staying with VITAS because of the overall excellence of the services that they provide. That being said, people have options. There are a lot of hospices out there. The depth of the services provided by VITAS, I have found, are head and shoulders above those of other hospices, simply because of their size, and they can provide cross coverage and greater amounts and intensities of services that in general other hospices can't. A mom and pop hospice simply cannot compete on that level. Once you get one or two very complicated patients that need around the clock care, which is provided frequently, or at the very minimum, eight out of 24 hours of a nurse there, or a CNA or an LVN there in the home, that would overwhelm, I would imagine, almost every mom and pop out there, because you just can't staff adequately when you have a low census. It's just not economically feasible to do so.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And how does somebody find a good hospice to go with? What's the kind of resources out there? What do you suggest they do if they're faced with they want to do hospice, but you know, where do they start, or finding one that's going to meet their needs?
Yeah, you know, first of all, have you had a family member who's been treated by a hospice, and what were their services like? The issue with hospice is you may get one or two or perhaps three exposures to hospice services, but you can't actually shop for services. You can't really compare and contrast very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You have to experience it and then judge it, and then,
sure,
did this work for me or did this not work for me? So, you know, I always encourage people, if you had a good experience with a previous hospice organization and they're still in your area, by all means, contact them.
What about somebody that decides that they're not real happy with that particular hospice organization? Is it hard to change to a different hospice?
It's not hard at all. We get switchovers all the time, especially for mom and pop organizations. So all they have to do is request it, and they will fill out a form, and I don't know what the form looks like. They'll disenroll from that hospice, and a new assessment of the patient is performed by an admissions nurse for that hospice,
okay,
and then new paperwork is filled out so that there is a seamless transition. Now, it has been my experience that when the hospice that I work for, VITAS, is involved, if there is any issue with equipment, let's say the person wants to transition from VITAS to another hospice, if there's any issue with the delivery of equipment,
mm-hmm,
the VITAS equipment will stay until the new equipment arrives.
Okay.
And then there won't be, okay, we're done, now we're going to take our toys and go.
Make them lay on the couch and wait for the
bedroom. Exactly. none of that happens, right?
Yeah,
and we try to be proactive as well, getting in front of the discharge so that the house or the skilled nursing facility is already set up.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing you want is for people waiting in the ambulance on the curb because the bed hasn't arrived, the oxygen concentrator hasn't arrived, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Right.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, but patients and their families could meet with, before they sign on to a hospice, they can meet with multiple hospice reps and just kind of gauge from there.
Because yes,
if they meet with them, it's no obligation meeting, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I frequently will tell families, get to know them. You don't have to sign anything.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're ready to do so, if you're ready to do so, judge what you think is going to be the best and then go with those people. And just know that at any time you have options.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Wow. Okay. I think we're really covered a lot of great information for our listeners today. You know,
we did. Yes, that's great.
Oh, I wanted to ask one more thing. And
okay.
I was trying to not forget it, and I almost did.
Almost did.
For me personally, I find it important is the part about the DNR, the do not resuscitate, and having CPR. So I think there's some hospices that require that you be a do not resuscitate, does VITAS require that now, or can you be a full code? Or
yeah, you can with the VITAS organization, you can be a full code patient, and that's usually an ongoing discussion because lots of times people don't want to go in that direction because they view it as quote unquote giving up, or they still want to maintain some control over their lives,
mm-hmm.
and you're often seeing people who are having their control issues challenged and their body image issues challenged all the time,
right.
And they feel like they're losing control, and so it's an ongoing discussion, and it almost always resolves well,
mm-hmm.
and you can define that any way you like, but things usually work out. But you don't have to be a DNR. We don't want to put hard and fast stipulations in
sure.
front of families who are in distress already. And
right.
When you're working with people who are actively grieving, as we were talking about, waiting until the 11th hour to engage hospice services mm-hmm. or palliative medicine services, it can be very, very difficult engaging people in educating them when they're actively grieving.
Right.
Right? So yeah. We don't want to be rule-bound. We want to be care-bound.
Mm, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's also
but that being said, there are certain rules we have to abide by.
Sure.
It's just simply that's the way it is.
Absolutely.
And I think it'd be a shame to go through all this and not touch about one of the new things that's happening in the hospice world, and that's with the assisted suicide with California.
Oh, yeah.
If you could kind of touch on what's the latest. I'm not sure I totally understand what's going on with that myself.
Great question. So the new law was enacted in June of this year, and you as a healthcare provider do not have to participate in any way with this. However, when people ask for information, we give information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if the person wishes to end their lives, there is a cocktail that they can purchase. It's rather expensive. And mix with a drink and take that drink on an empty stomach, and it is 100% effective.
Wow.
Okay, so
wow.
They've gotten the formula down. Okay, but in order to qualify for purchasing that,
mm-hmm.
the person should be seen by two healthcare professionals, at least one of them with training in psychology or psychiatry, to help establish that...
They are of sound mind.
They are of sound mind, that they have capacity to make such an important decision, and the visits have to happen at least 2 weeks apart.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so it's not an instantaneous thing.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to see a physician and then wait at least 2 weeks to see a second physician, get that certification, and then once that is done, you're eligible to buy the pills, which then you self-administer in a private setting.
And if you're not able to self-administer, then you don't get it.
You don't get it. You don't get it. A stand-in cannot perform it for you under the law.
Wow.
And what is what have you seen, just maybe glance at this, or maybe you can kind of tell us what you've seen so far on the reception from most physicians? Is it mixed?
Most physicians I work with do not wish to participate in mm-hmm. in the process, but we give out information freely as soon as the request is made. We notify the families or the patient themselves about how to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And we have case management working in our organization that will help clarify any questions that they have as well.
This is pretty much the same style that Oregon is doing, or are they doing something?
Pretty much, yes. There's a lot of restrictions to it, of course, but you have to take it yourself. You have to
right.
administer it yourself in a private setting. So there are hurdles, and the hurdles are two separate evaluations sure. to establish soundness of mind and terminal prognosis as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
All right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Terminal prognosis, does it have to be within a certain time frame?
Good question. I have to look it up.
I'm not sure either.
Well, if you're under that 6-month window for the hospital, but I don't know.
There's also palliative medicine patients who know, let's say with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, a diagnosis which will cause progressive debility over time and for which there is no cure, at least at this time.
Right.
You know, it's a reasonable question. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. So maybe we'll find out more. You know, that could be a
next show.
Another show we can maybe dive into that a little deeper. So we find out more about it, and we can maybe compare and contrast with what Oregon's doing. Right. But that could be a good show too. All right. Well, we're about out of time, but we'd like to thank Dr. Cortez for coming on and being very forthcoming about palliative care and hospice. You answered some great questions. I think you shed even more light on this very serious subject.
Absolutely.
And we're really trying to a lot of education is needed out there. And I see it firsthand almost every day, and so does Roy. And we just really,
Yeah, thank you for coming on, Doc. I think you've made it very clear for a lot of people to have a better understanding of everything that goes on with this.
Thank you. Glad to help. Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Roy.
Great. Thank you so much. Oh, and by the way, I just wanted to touch really quick. You're also, I don't know if anybody knows this, but as everybody knows that I wrote a book called The Ill-Informed Patient, available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. And you are also an author. And I wanted to, because you're not just a doctor. But I want to say
I'm doing my best at writing a series of children's adventures.
That's
they're
right.
not published yet, but yeah. we're working on it. It's a side gig.
Oh yeah, so we will keep you updated. We'll keep you updated, folks, regarding his progress on it. And I've been able to see some of the stuff, and it looks really fantastic. So we're gonna wish you the best of luck on that. So
thank you, Eric.
Very nice. So. All right. Well, again, folks, that's the end of our show. And if you want more information about VITAS, that's VITAS, you can get a hold of them. And we'll have the information on our website and with the description of the show. So with that said, we'd like to thank you very much for listening to the Informed Patient Radio Show, and like us on Facebook. Everybody, take care.
This has been The Informed Patient Show with Eric and Roy. Join us next time as we learn more about how to better navigate the healthcare system. For more information about the hosts and the show, visit our website at www.informedpt.com. And please like us on Facebook.